This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a talented singer and actor from Glace Bay is heading to the Big Apple after being accepted into a master's program at NYU. Also, we'll hear about an upcoming fundraiser for the Hawks Dreamfield Project, featuring some of Cape Breton's best talent. And we'll hear from a kids' book illustrator on The Good Sentence who recently won a big award for his work. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Starting out with Paul McDougall on The Good Sentence, we hear from Sydney Smith, a children's book illustrator who lives in Halifax with his wife and two sons. He's won numerous international awards for illustration, including the Governor General's Award, and just last month, the Kate Greenaway Medal, and that's out of a field of 152 international entrants for his book, Small in the City.
So, Sydney, you've had some great success with your latest illustrated children's book, which you also wrote, Small in the City?
That's right, yeah, Small in the City.
Yeah, why don't we, let's just tell us just a little bit about this, and for our listeners on the coast, you had just won the CLIP Kate Greenaway Medal for this just a couple of weeks ago. As far as I understand, its titles are selected by children's librarians in the UK, and there are 152 titles were selected this year, and then it was narrowed down to 20, and then you were the winner. So congratulations from all of Nova Scotia for that. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about that particular book first?
Well, the book is called Small in the City, and it's one that I wrote and illustrated. Actually, it's not my latest one because this one is a couple years old, but because of the scheduling with releasing it in the UK, I was able to be part of the nomination process. My book was nominated for this year, which is great because I have seen Small in the City have a bit of a life during its first release here in Canada, and then it kind of got quiet, and now it's back. Now it's big, and back in a big way, you know, with the Kate Greenaway, which is one of the most prestigious awards in illustration for picture books.
Exactly.
So,
I'm just going to tell our listeners that you won the Governor General's Award in 2019 for this particular book as well,
right,
for children's illustration. So I'll let you continue, though. Keep talking about it.
Okay, yeah, sure. And it's true. I've had a lot of great fortune, and this book has gone beyond what I had even expected when I first wrote and illustrated it back when I was living in Toronto. The book itself is set in Toronto. It's set in my neighborhood, which is downtown Toronto, very much in the center of the city, and the book itself is about just what it's like to be small in the city. The particular city is Toronto, but it's not specific to Toronto. It could be any kind of North American city. Except there are a few clues throughout the book that, you know, if you were...
The streetcars.
Streetcars, exactly. And if I walked you through it, I could identify all of the different locations and all the places that maybe you might recognize if you were familiar with Toronto.
It looks like around Queen Street area, kind of, some of it to me.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I was living not too far from Yonge and Dundas, which is the busiest intersection in the country.
Yeah.
And so I sourced a lot of the book from just where I was living and how I was feeling, coming from the East Coast, living in the big city. And, you know, you never really fully get used to it. You still feel like a bit of a country mouse when you're walking around in such a big place. So that's what the book is about. There's lots of layers to the book. So I wanted to do something I had never worked on before. You know, this is the first time that I've illustrated for my own text. And but before this, I've illustrated for I don't know, like 12 different books for other people, for the words of other people. And that's always fun, and it always there's always a great element of collaboration and a lot of interesting results come from the teamwork that happens between the text of someone else and my drawings. But there was always something I had not quite seen yet, and I wanted to try that out with this book.
It starts off with the little child who's not too old, maybe 7, 8, something like that, maybe younger, stepping off the streetcar onto this really busy street. And you know, from the title, you get the small as a small person, and you wonder what's going on here. But as you said, this is another level to the story, because there's a character in the story that's even much smaller than the little child, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And so there's a lot of layers and double meanings and subtexts, and it's a bit of a challenge, I think, but with a reward, you know. And kids, it doesn't go over anybody's heads. Maybe a few, but if anyone who hasn't got it, they were older people. It was actually all the kids that I read it to. They all got it first time they read through it. But
I'm thinking kids may pick up on what the little child is doing quicker than adults, because it was like pretty well towards the end, and then I thought, oh yeah, and I clued in on all the you'd be warm here on top by this grate, or you'd
sit out on this
window ledge, and then, you know, I don't want to really actually ruin it for listeners who I really think should go out and get this for, you know, adults will love reading it, but if you've got grandchildren or small children, it's just an absolutely lovely book, and it's a heartfelt thing, and it's almost sort of a heartbreaker at the end, but it isn't, because there's a lot of hope there too for what is going on in that little child's mind, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. It might not have a sort of a nicely packaged ending, but the whole point of it is about this journey through the city, but also a journey through, you know, processing loss and trying to understand things that are beyond your control. There's some very heavy things there that I think everybody of any age, experiences.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you work in those kind of universal terms, I think you know, your audience just becomes, you know, bigger and bigger. And so I think that's how I try to work, is sort of these themes that affect and relate to everybody from any age.
I was really taken with it all and kind of flabbergasted, and because it's, you know, it's not a 100-page piece of work or anything, but there is so much packed in there, and I'm going to copy what the Greenway, the judges said. The award, they look for the award to give to someone who has achieved outstanding reader experience. So, you know, out of 152, I would say, man, that's really nice to have gotten that award. And that is what that is. That's what you've done. It is outstanding.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, it kind of blows me away to hear that, because I forget. It's not small peanuts, you know. This award is given by experts. And I'm nominated next to some of the best in the world.
Exactly. And and this is the second time you've won. So your book from 2015, Sidewalk Flowers, correct?
No, it's
Town by
Towers by the Sea.
Town, okay, yes, Town, okay, for
even
our
better,
listeners.
Even better, because Towers by the Sea is set in Nova Scotia.
It's set in Nova Scotia, and this one was... yes, which you won in 2018, and this one was this is a collaboration with Joanna Swartz, and so many of our listeners here will know that name, because she's the daughter of Nuwatafort, business person and
right.
well-known philanthropist and everything else, Irving Schwartz. But I mean, just walk us through Town is by the Sea, because it's kind of a counterpoint to Small in the City, because now we're, well, you tell us where the town is and where the sea is.
Yeah, so, well, it's the Town is by the Sea is written by Joanne Schwartz, who lived near the, she lived in Sydney, I believe.
She lived in Sydney, yeah.
Yeah, but the town is not far from there, and it's the...
New Waterford, more or less.
What's that?
New Waterford, more or less.
Yeah.
Where the story's set, right?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. And I did get a chance to go and visit there. It wasn't in the summer, and the sun was not shimmering off of the water, but it was still a very educational trip. I was able to go there, and the kind people at the Miners Museum were able to let me in and walk around. They were closed, but there were a few people just hanging around. Mm-hmm. So I was able to explore, and it was invaluable research for the book. I really couldn't have done it without them. And it was such a great experience too, because when I was living in Toronto, I was working on this.
Okay.
I was really missing my home and missing my family, and felt really disconnected from home. So every time I was able to work on this book, I was transporting myself back home, back to the ocean, and back to Nova Scotia. And I knew that, you know, when I was working on this book, I had to do my best to try to represent back east and, friends and family and my neighbors and everyone that I felt such a kinship with. I had to do it, and for it to receive the green away, that was just I felt like it wasn't really just for me. It was for it was for Nova Scotia. It was for Cape Breton. It was for, you know, I was representing not just myself but my people as well in a way.
Yeah, it's just a lovely story. And again, a small child, a little boy. It starts off with. He's looking out the window and he's talking about how close this little coal mining town is. And then there's a really neat scene where you see him in the mirror. I really like how you did that. And he's kind of just getting up out of bed. And then he looks out the window and he talks about the sea. And the next minute he's like, and for people that don't come from a coal mining place to say, my father is already out 2 hours working underneath the sea, right? I mean, that would... That's something that, you know, really, unless you're Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, or Scotland, you know, places like that, under the sea, coal mining is just a unique thing that doesn't happen everywhere. And how you told that story, I found was really neat. And, you know, the colors of above ground and then below ground, showing all the men going down in the rake. Really, that was a touching story.
It's powerful. It's so powerful, and I feel really grateful to have been part of that project. You know, it was a great. It was like it's champagne casting, I guess they could call it. But like Joanne and I were just like getting on so well together, and still really good friends.
Yeah. So did
our editor, like also big props to Groundwood Books, who was the publisher, and Sheila Berry, our editor at the time. She was amazing, incredible person.
So how does that process work? Like work me through that one a little bit. Does like Joanna go to the publisher with a story and then the publisher finds the illustrator? Is that how it's kind of normally done?
That's right. Yeah. So the publisher is kind of the matchmaker. They have people that they're comfortable working with. They know how to, you know, they know that they have a good rapport with. And so when someone comes to them with a manuscript, the publisher or editor, usually they'll ask the author, you know, you have anybody in mind? And then they'll work it out. It's not like they just grab any old person. They figure out what's best for the book, and usually the author has some style in mind or maybe even a specific artist, but you never really see, it's very rare that an author and illustrator will approach a publisher together with a finished project or a team that's already been created, because the publisher really likes to use the people they're familiar with and comfortable with and can rely on, and it's, you know, they're dependable and predictable with the quality of their work.
Yeah. Let's go back now to this this one from 2015, which you won the Governor General's Award for, Sidewalk Flowers. And yeah. So you illustrated this one, which again, it's set in Toronto. The scenes are some of them are similar to the latest book in Small in the City. And you did this with John Arno Lawson, but there's no words. This one is all it's just the images. So how did that work? Like, how did his part? I have the story, but I have no word. How did that work for you?
Yeah, so I was coming from Nova Scotia, just moving to Toronto, and got my editor from Groundwood, Sheila Berry. She got in touch with me, saying, you know, I've seen some of your illustrations. Would you like to do a picture book for us? That was like the I knew it the moment I opened that email, the moment I read her words, I knew that was going to be a huge deal for me. I mean, I already knew who Groundwood was. They're big. They get awards. You know, they make beautiful books.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly who I really, my dream publisher. And so I was given this project of Sidewalk Flowers, and they said, it's a wordless book, so it's all your drawings. Here's the story, and it's all kind of paced out and paginated, and you know, it's pretty much there, written out, but I take what's written and interpret it with the drawings. But this was my chance to really shine, you know, prove myself as an illustrator to, you know, a new kind of a broader market, and I did, you know, I knocked it out of the park, not to be, you know.
No, but you did.
But I did. I mean, as so much time has passed, I'm able to really look back and be like, wow, I really, like, that was a huge deal for me. I didn't have kids at the time, so I was, like, staying up all night. I was working 7 days a week. I didn't sleep. I really just did my best to try to make that a beautiful book, and it worked out. All of a sudden, I'm in the New York Times, and I'm being reviewed by major reviewers and newspapers, places I have never been before, and it just sort of launched my career. And, you know, again, it's thanks to Groundwood, and it's thanks to John Arno Lawson, who had a great story about sharing, about empathy. You know, it's all of the big themes are within it, but there's no words.
Yeah, it starts off the father and the little girl, and she's all in red. She looks like Little Red Riding Hood almost.
Yeah.
And was that his idea or your idea? Because a lot of the background is kind of black and white in the beginning of the book, so she stands out as this red figure.
That's right. Yeah. No. She. I don't think the red was part of the plan at first. What was suggested was that the colors would become more vibrant as she gave out flowers.
Yeah.
Now I took that to such an extent that it was black and white at the beginning of the book, and then at the end of the book, it's lush and saturated with color. It's just to kind of really just to express this feeling, this warmth that kind of takes over the book as she gives out these more of these secret flowers to everyone.
And basically,
they know it or not.
Yeah, and it's gradual as this happens, because it's kind of like as she's in the busier part of town and it's picking the flowers, and we're talking like dandelions and little flowers sticking out of cracks and buildings and this and that that most people don't even notice or see or care about, but a child would, and they're at their height, and then slowly as they wind their way back into their neighborhood, and she starts giving them out, and then the colors of the neighborhood all sort of come alive, and you see it subtly in like a woman's dress, whereas the background isn't so colorful, and bottles in a window are colorful, the window isn't, and then but as you go you get further and further. But I tell you, one of the more really touching things is the first flower she gives away, it's to like a dead bird on the sidewalk, a dead pigeon or something. I thought, oh my god, this is what she's gonna do.
Yeah.
You know, and really that's what a kid would do, right? You know.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, kids really focus on that part of the story, I think. You know, that's really the most, it's a part of the story that sticks out the most to kids. And it's not like, it's not a morbid fascination or anything.
No.
It's dark at all. It's just a curiosity.
Yeah.
And, I think it's very natural and speaks to the curious mind that, we all have, especially when we're young.
Yeah, it's, you're doing really fabulous work, and you live in Halifax now, right?
Yeah, we moved back from Toronto with our two kids.
Yeah.
Toronto was too small for us.
That's right. So you have two boys. What do they think of their dad as like a children's book illustrator? What do they think of that? Is it just routine to them? That's what you do? Or?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's just my job, you know. It's natural. It's normal to them. We love to draw together. And my oldest son, he is an incredible drawer already, and he loves to draw. And I'm, you know, I'm really proud of that. Of course, if he didn't draw, I'd still be proud of him. But
yeah,
I do love getting, you know, sitting down at the table and just spending a long time inventing things with him on paper.
Yeah, you have said that you started drawing yourself at a very young age, and it was you considered it a safe haven or a place to escape to. And you, like, this is what you do all the time, and you draw all the time. You can't not draw. It's like a muscle to you, right?
Well, that's it. It is it's a muscle that needs to be, you know, it will atrophy if you stop for too long. You got to keep your keep sharp,
yeah.
Keep it warmed up and stretching, and, you know, even after a weekend of not drawing, I can feel it. It's a little bit rusty, so yeah. I gotta keep on it.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations on the latest awards, and look forward to what's your newest book since that book.
Yeah. So since that book, it's a book with Neil Porter and Holiday House. Neil Porter Books and Holiday House out of New York, written by Jordan Scott, a poet from out west in BC on Victoria Island, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that Vancouver Island?
Vancouver Island, yeah.
Anyway, he's amazing. It's a story about him based on his own experience growing up with a stutter.
Okay.
And it's beautiful. You know, it's a wonderful book, and I'm really proud of it. And I'm looking forward to working with him again soon.
What's that called?
This book's called I Talk Like a River.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yep.
So, listen, when the pandemic is all over and you can move around somewhat, you should get down to Cape Breton sometime and do something in one of the two Sydney bookstores. How's that?
I'd love it. Yeah, I'll bring the kids and bring the family.
Great. Okay. Listen, Sydney, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Lisa McNeil Campbell is one of the volunteers behind the Hawks Dreamfield project. The landmark ball field in Dominion is getting a facelift thanks to a lot of hard work by the community. Lisa joins us this week to get us up to date on the progress, and she'll also tell us about a fundraiser set for July 24th.
Well, this project started just over 2 years ago. Today, my dad passed away 2 years ago on June 23rd. and his name was Walter McNeil. He was very much into his community, and he loved his family, and he was very much into sports. So he loved baseball, all things baseball. He coached, he played, and everything else. So after he had passed, my family and I just decided that we would like to do a project in his honor for a couple of reasons. One, to keep us busy, kind of, you know, to help us get through the grief. And then just another to do something good for the community and continue his legacy. So with that, we decided to do something. We got some people together in the town, and we just kind of thought through all different ideas. What can we do? What can we do? And the obvious choice was to redo the Hawks Field in Dominion. We did that because Dad's mantra was kind of always, everybody gets to play. So we wanted to make sure that there was a place where every child and everybody could come and safely play baseball, go for a walk, jump in a splash pad, join their friends, get together with family, you know, do all those great things and be safe.
So, Lisa, there's quite an impressive history for the ball field in Dominion. It says on your website, going back as far as 1908, with fathers, grandfathers, and even great-grandfathers playing on that original Dominion Hawks team.
Sure. It started, the field was built in 1911, so far as I am aware. It started with the Colliery Leagues, of course, and that was a big deal. And at that time, they used to recruit players from the States and everything to come here to play ball. And with the mines, the collieries all had their own leagues, and they played against one another, and it was very competitive. People used to actually have to pay to get into the games at the ball fields, which was very cool. There was a gentleman, his name was Heck Andrews, and he was from the Gardner area. He was on the Hawks team. He drove the longest home run recorded in Canada in 1938, I believe it was, 478 feet out into the ocean with a wooden bat. And it just so happened that there were fishermen out there, and they caught the ball. So we actually have the ball, and we have the actual bat that he used. His grandson, Bruce Carabin, is now on our team to redevelop the field. So it's pretty exciting. My dad also was he was on the Hawks team, and his father was on the Hawks team, baseball team. And my dad was one of the founding members of the Dominion Community Hawks Club.
And as you said, this revitalization is being dedicated to your father, Walter McNeil. What do you think he would say about all of this?
Oh, I think he would be super pleased because the field has been let go quite a bit now. You know, there's just been, through, over the years, it just gets roughed up and stuff like that. So to see it not only get upgraded, the baseball field piece of it, but to add the pieces on that we're going to with the walking track and the bocce courts and the splash pad and all of those things, and to make it 100% accessible so that every child gets to play, he would be over the moon happy.
And there will be something there for everyone. It's not just a ball field. It's a multi-use facility.
Well, and that's just it, right? The big thing is that we want to make sure that it's for people to be able to be social and to get out for to welcome new members to the community. New people are coming all of the time. We're becoming so diverse. We want to welcome people to our community and let them come and join other people and get to play baseball or go for a nice walk. Unfortunately, the beach used to be a great walk. We had a boardwalk there that was absolutely gorgeous. With the erosion and lots of storms down at the beach, it's been really difficult for people to walk, especially seniors or people with mobility issues. So having a safe walking track that still gives them visibility of the ocean, but the safety of a safe walking track and lighting and seats where they can stop and have a little rest if they need to, you know, that's going to mean a lot for people.
And there will be a new building there too, right?
The building will be a canteen facility plus washrooms, and we'll have two washrooms that are fully accessible. Both will have full-size, like adult-size change tables in them, which is a huge deal. I don't think they're anywhere else here in Cape Breton that anybody has them. You know, you don't really realize what you need unless you're in that situation. I spoke to the mom, her name is Nicole. I spoke to her. She has a son who's teenager, and he's an adult size. And she said, you know, it's very difficult for her to take him places, and she needs to be able to change him if need be. And the child's tables that are in washrooms right now, they're not large enough. So she would have to bring him all the way back home just for that purpose. So to have a space where children of all sizes can be, you know, can get their needs looked after without having to go home or go to another facility is wonderful. The inside of the canteen will also be accessible, so people that may be in wheelchairs or have mobility issues can still volunteer or work within the inside of the canteen. And then the outside, the walk-up window for serving is also going to have a space where wheelchairs can roll up and place their orders on their own, so they won't need assistance to do that.
You know, people have been idle for so long because of COVID, and are people talking to you about the idea of giving the community and Dominion something to look forward to where they can put their energy instead of, you know, thinking about COVID and doing something productive?
Oh, I think so. The support for this field has been absolutely overwhelming. People have been very excited. We're getting, you know, messages from folks saying, oh my goodness, I can't wait to go there. I can't wait to play, and I can't wait to bring my grandchildren when I come home from away. And so people are certainly looking forward to it. I know, like, families with children who do have disabilities, and they just cannot wait for the splash pad to be available to them. Right now at Dominion Beach, you cannot take a wheelchair down on the beach unless somebody picks it up and carries it. You know, it's not accessible. So to have a place where the children can enjoy the water and get cooled off and be with other children is an amazing opportunity. So and we will continue to build upon the field, you know, as we go. It won't just stop when the first part of it is finished. You know, we'll keep adding and making it better and better as we go.
So we have to give a bit of a plug here, Lisa. The Coast is teaming up with Blair's Used Furniture and Appliances and Scheller Convenience as the sponsors for A Cape Breton Night by the Fire, and that's on July 24th. So, yeah, what's happening there?
It's super exciting. This is our second A Cape Breton Night by the Fire event, and it is a fundraising event. It's going to be streamed online on our Facebook page, our YouTube page, by NovaStream. So they're on board to help us out. And Malcolm McMillan, of course, who is going to be doing the sound for us. We've got some incredible entertainers, including your very own Donnie Campbell from Celtic Serenade. And he'll have with him Jinx O'Neill, of course. And we've got Aaron Lewis and Kimberly Fraser, Nipper McLeod from the Men of the Deep, Heather Kerr, Mario Colosimo, Debbie McMullen, the Turnbull Brothers from Glace Bay, just an incredible lineup of people. We also announced today that we're going to have an outside audience. We're going to be filming this outside, of course, should the weather, as long as the weather holds. And we'll be able, because the restrictions are getting lifted a bit, we'll be able to have an outside audience so people can buy tickets to be on hand as well as watch it online.
Where can people find out more about the event?
Sure. So they can go on our website at hawkstreamfield.ca, or they can go to our Facebook page, which is, again, Hawk Streamfield. And if they wanted to ask some questions, anybody wants to ask some questions, you can certainly give me a call at, you know, on the number on the page on our homepage, or 574-5461. And we'd be happy to answer any questions that they might have. We're also doing a T-shirt campaign to help boost the funds that we're hoping to raise on that day. The T-shirts are awesome. They're actually another one of our sponsors is Fully Promoted Cape Breton from Sydney River, and they're helping us with the T-shirts. And the picture on them is just so sweet. It says "Getting Toasted at Cape Breton Night by the Fire," and it's got a couple of lobsters toasting marshmallows. And they got their fisherman's hat on, and they're having a really great time. So the T-shirts are $20, and they are also available on our website.
What else can people do to get involved?
Oh, absolutely. There's going to be lots. Actually, we're hoping to have a baseball tournament coming up, which we'll need some help with. We'd like to have one more on the field before the construction begins in August. So we're going to have that, and we're always having fundraisers on the go, so we can always use help if anybody is interested in getting involved. We're also looking for corporate, you know, sponsors, so people who are interested in helping in that way, that's awesome.
Can you talk about the construction getting underway in August? Can you elaborate on that, Lisa, please?
So the first phase begins in August. We've been working with our landscape architects, who are Glenn Group, and they work with Dillon Consulting here in Sydney. And they've been absolutely fantastic to work with. They had to do some soils testing and stuff like that to make sure that everything underneath the ground when they tear it all up is solid, and that they put the proper soil on top when they put the turf on. So they're finishing up that kind of stuff now, and then we'll get started in the fall with all of the underground work, in August with all the underground work, and they're going to have our plan for exactly what they'll finish up until October. We have $1.2 million on hand now that we've raised between the government funding and our own fundraising. And then we have to raise another 1.3. So that's why we have to have these events. We are also, as a team, we are responsible to raise part of the money ourselves, of course, not just depend on government money or grant money. You know, it's our responsibility also to do what we can. We've been so lucky. We've raised over $80,000 so far on our own just in a year and a half.
What would you like to say about the generosity of Cape Bretoners when it comes to work like this?
Absolutely, second to none, and beyond overwhelming. It's been incredible. It's really heartwarming to see how many people support their own. They're excited for the project. They're supporting because, you know, many people are supporting because they knew my dad, and they just love Dominion, and they love the Hawks. You know, all about the history of the Hawks and everything like that. So it's been quite overwhelming. Yeah, it's been amazing. We also have a donor wall. People have been donating to that as well since about the last year and a half. So once the field is the ground is prepared, we'll be putting the new donor wall up. It is on the website virtually now, so people can donate in honor of or in memory of a loved one. And they'll have those names that will be put up onto the donor wall when the field is finished.
Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
I'm trying to think. If I could just, there's a few people I'd like to thank. You know, Marcy Shwery Stanley was huge in supporting our project and trying to help us with getting information and getting to the right people at the beginning of the project and right through. So she's been incredibly supportive. Our government officials here have been amazing. Councillor Darren Brookschwager from Dominion, Mayor Clark, when he was here, he started the project off with his support, so we couldn't have started without him. And then Mayor Amanda McDougall was totally on board when she came in, and we're so grateful for that. Mike Calloway, MP Mike Calloway, Jeff McClellan, MLA, and MLA Derek Mumberkett, I have to say every one of them have been incredibly wonderful to us and supportive. So we really can't thank them enough.
Yes, so it seems people didn't hesitate to get involved. Did that come as a surprise to you that it was unfolding at this pace?
I've been teased a million times over that this hasn't been done before, not that anybody can remember anyway, so quickly and to have such huge support so fast and so big for a project. And we are incredibly proud. We have a beautiful team that is really working so hard to make this happen. Like, everybody on the team is 100% all in and ready to work and giving it everything they got to make sure that this happens. And not just, I mean, people are donating their very hard-earned money to help us get this done. We don't want it sitting in an account for 5-6 years and people wondering, okay, well, where did my money go? We want this to happen soon. So I want people to see that the money that they're donating really is going to a project that they're going to see very shortly. They're going to see tractors on that field in August. If all goes well and, you know, we get a little bit of corporate funding and there's some grants that we've been applying for, we're hoping to complete the project next spring.
So thanks to Lisa McNeil Campbell for spending time with us this week, talking about the Hawks Dreamfield Project in Dominion and about a fundraiser coming up on July 24th at Cape Breton Night by the Fire. And we'll be in touch, Lisa. Good luck in the meantime.
Thanks so much for talking to me and asking and inviting me, Bill. I really appreciate it, and the whole team does. And we hope to see you at a Cape Breton Night by the Fire.
New York University doesn't accept just anyone into its Masters of Music Theater program. Out of the countless applications, only a handful are selected, and Emily O'Leary of Glace Bay is one of those talented few, but as you can imagine, it's expensive to live in the Big Apple, and here she is now talking about her Cape Breton roots in music and theater.
I grew up in Glace Bay and was very lucky that I was in a musical family. My dad plays the guitar and my mom is always singing. When I was 11 or 12, I was lucky enough to join Gail Leahy's Glace Bay Glee Group. And that was my first introduction to performing on stage and singing in front of an audience. And since then, I was just kind of hooked on the whole feeling of getting to perform and make music. And after that, I performed in Les Mis at the Savoy, and that was my first big musical theater experience, and that was sort of the gateway for the path that I'm on now.
So you've been accepted into a master's program at the world-famous NYU for the upcoming fall, and only 12 students are selected every year for this course, and you can only imagine how many people apply for that. But getting someone from Cape Breton this year into this master's program, can you talk a little bit about your interest in attending NYU, and what was the application process like?
Well, NYU was actually a dream school of mine. I remember one of the first times I got to travel to New York City, I was walking around through the campus and I just kind of fell in love with the city and the school. So when it came time to look at master's programs, I was really looking in a direction towards musical theater because that's my number one passion. But at the same time, I really love teaching, and a program like the one I was accepted to, which combines vocal performance and vocal pedagogy, is virtually non-existent in Canada. So it just so happened that my two worlds collided and my perfect program was also in my perfect city, New York. So I've been very fortunate to have been accepted.
Can you talk about some of the projects you'll be working on with your fellow students?
Yeah. So the course combines the study of vocal performance with vocal pedagogy. So the vocal performance area will allow me to further my lessons with amazing instructors and study the field of musical theater. So I'm going to be taking dance classes and acting classes and lots of voice training. And on the other side of the coin, the vocal pedagogy area of the course will allow me to kind of study the art and science of teaching voice, and as well, while I'm studying vocal pedagogy, I will be an adjunct faculty member at NYU and am able to teach undergrad students voice while I'm there. So it's a fantastic opportunity.
So what was your reaction like when you found out you were accepted into the program?
Well, it was actually a long waiting process. I had a pre-screen audition in December, and then I found out that I was invited to audition come January, and my audition was in February. Then I waited about a month and hadn't heard much, so I actually sent an email to one of the heads of the department, and she was so kind and gracious and basically said, "You'll be hearing from us soon." So later that day, I checked my NYU portal and happened to see that it was updated. And I don't think that I will ever forget that moment because I definitely screamed a lot and cried a lot and immediately called my mom and my voice teacher at school and told them the amazing news.
For your application, what did you send to the school for them to consider your acceptance into the program?
So the application kind of consists of two areas. Obviously, there's an academic component, and I'm very fortunate that I love school and studying, so I kept a high GPA through undergrad, so I think that was in my favor. And then, of course, there's a singing and an audition component. So for that, I think I had to prepare four songs and a monologue, as well as a teaching sample of me teaching someone's voice. So one of my best friends actually volunteered to help me with that portion of the audition.
So growing up in a community like Lace Bay, heading to a big city like New York, you mentioned that you had been there before, but what are you expecting, or are you prepared for a bit of a culture shock when you live there?
I am so excited to move to a big city. It's kind of been a dream of mine. I love Lace Bay and I love small towns, but city life, I think, is where I'm meant to be. It definitely is nerve-wracking, though, because I've never spent a prolonged amount of time in a city. So I'm very, very lucky that I've gotten to travel to New York multiple times while I was younger. And that actually, I think, has prepared me very well for living there, because I kind of know my way around the subway lines and the areas to go to and to avoid, and you know how to navigate the ups and downs of a huge city like New York.
A lot of people here say the arts community on the island and its performers, they punch above their weight class. And who are some of the people who helped you develop your artistic skills along the way?
Yeah, for sure. So many people have helped me along the way. I don't even think I can begin to name any. I would love to give a special shout out to Robin Cathcart, who directed the very first musical I was in, Les Mis. That was such an amazing opportunity for little 12-year-old me. And of course, Wesley Colford at the Highland Arts Theater. They are just a wonderful human making wonderful art and have given me so many opportunities. There are so many people to thank. I guess my last dedication would be to Ron Jenkins, who has been a director of mine for the past few years, and he was actually the one that helped me put together some fundraising ideas for this endeavor.
So it's a very expensive endeavor. What can you say about the financial responsibility in order to see this happen for you?
Yeah, NYU it's a beautiful, well-renowned school, but the financial aspect of it is really quite prohibitive, I would imagine, for many, many people, no matter what your financial circumstance. Unfortunately, the costs are around $75,000 in American money. So, of course, that translates to about $100,000 in Canadian money. So, obviously, that is very, very out of reach for it was certainly for me and my family. So when I first got accepted, it was kind of a whirlwind of, okay, well, how are we actually going to do this? So I've been very lucky that NYU actually awarded me $15,000 in scholarships, which I will be able to renew into my second year of the program as well. I also have multiple scholarships coming from all kinds of local Canadian arts foundations, such as the Nova Scotia Talent Trust and the Julie Martel Scholarship, the Ruth Goldblum Scholarship for Performing Arts. I've been applying to everything I can get my hands on, and I've been so lucky that I've gotten a few, and that's really, really been helping. And, you know, I obviously have lots of student loans, as many do. But unfortunately, even with all of that, it's still so much money and just, you know, out of reach. So we're working really hard to try and bridge that gap.
What can people do to help if they want to help you see your dream come true in attending NYU?
Well, we have a GoFundMe set up that the lovely Ron Jenkins, who I mentioned earlier, actually set up for me. I can't thank him enough for having done that for me, and I cannot thank any of the donors enough. Like, I am so surprised that anyone, you know, wants to help me out, and I appreciate it so, so, so much. So if anyone is interested, we do have the GoFundMe still up. We're aiming for around $15,000, which hopefully if we reach that point, everything would be set to go. And I think I, you know, would be in a stable enough position to make sure that I could go. So I appreciate all of the efforts that have already went into that. And I, again, can't thank everyone who's been helping me enough. It's been crazy and amazing.
What kind of reaction are you getting on social media? Are you putting the news out there of someone from Glace Bay that is attending NYU? Are you getting a positive feedback on social media too?
Yeah, I've been sharing it a lot, especially with lots and lots of friends, those who I haven't heard from in a long time and those who are new. And it's really wild that so many people are congratulatory and seem to be rooting for me. It literally just kind of makes me tear up a little. And I've been encouraging my family to share it with friends and coworkers. And I honestly am just so surprised that, you know, anyone is giving it the time of day, let alone making donations that are going to help me reach this goal.
Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
I don't think so. Just thanks to everybody who has helped me along the way. I cannot express how grateful I am, and I am so excited to get to New York and see what the future holds.
Okay, so we have on the line Emily O'Leary, a singer and actor from Glace Bay, who's been selected as only one of 12 to be accepted into the Masters of Music Theater at NYU. And as Emily explained, she's looking for a bit of a financial boost from the community. It takes more than talent to study in New York. It takes quite a bit of money, too. And we're going to close out with Emily singing The Green Finch and Lit It Bird from the musical Sweeney Todd. Thanks so much for your time, Emily, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Is it rejoicing or merely hallowing? Are you discussing or flossing or simply dreaming? Are you crowing? Are you screaming? Winged dove and robinet, is it for wages singing to be sold? Have you decided it's safer in cages, singing when you're told? My cage has many rooms, damask and dark. Nothing there sings, not even my lark. Larks never will, you know, when they're captive, teach me to be more adaptive. Green finch and linnet bird, nightingale blackbird, teach me how to sing. If I cannot
That's all for Dialogue this week on the Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.